Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to our military men and women serving in the Middle East.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Hey, here we are. Another day, Veterans Row Radio. That's right. I'm looking across. This is Bob Gould, going to be your host today on Veterans Radio. I was just looking across the table from me, and it's Dale Throneberry, my partner, Dale.
It's frightening, isn't it?
Yes, we were trying to calculate how many programs are going on our ninth, the actual anniversary of our ninth day on the air. That was, what, like about 2 weeks, eh?
Right. We went on the air November 15th of 2003. And we're still here, amazingly.
We had to fight off the dinosaurs, didn't we, to get the station?
I think so. It's been a privilege and an honor, Bob, to work with you for those 9 years. And especially
I want to
thank Ken Rogge also. And, of course, we want to thank and remember our partner, Gary Lilly, for helping us get started and for getting us on the air and for us still being on the air. And, of course, we want to welcome Nina to the program today. Nina is running our board.
You're here.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And
it's nice to have the three of us back together again.
Well, it is. It's always good to have the three of us together and working on these programs. And Bob, I know you've got an amazing program lined up for today. And I think our audience is going to be amazed at the information that we're going to impart to them.
Don't forget, folks, if you have a question for our guest or a comment, call us at 1-877-573-7825. That's 1-877-573-7825. We pick it up. It's our nickel. And please call us up for comments. We are going to be covering, something. Our first guest is going to be Dr. Rebecca Grant. We're going to be covering something I knew nothing about. How about you, Dale?
No, after reading her article about drones, it was fascinating and alarming, to say the least, that we're not the only ones.
Are they out there? Yes, they are. And Dr. Grant will be on right after. But before we do our break, Dale, you have something to add.
I do. Every week on Veterans Radio, we like to promote an event that's being sponsored by some veterans organization around the country. And this one is going to be local, and it happens to be the Traveling Vietnam Memorial Wall is coming to Dearborn, Michigan. It's called The Wall That Heals, the Traveling Vietnam Veterans Memorial and Museum. It is being presented by the Dearborn Allied War Veterans Council, and this is going to be from October 25th through October 29th, it looks like, on the thing, starting at 10 a.m., and this is going to be at the Ford Motor Company World Headquarters on One American Road in Dearborn, Michigan. This is right off Michigan Avenue, for those of you who are in the local area. And it's
Michigan and Southfield.
Yes, and the keynote address is going to be done by by the founder and really the guiding source for the wall, and that's President Jan Scruggs. And Jan has been on Veterans Radio, and so I'm excited to go and listen to Jan again. And this is the 30th anniversary of the Vietnam War. We're starting to be like the greatest generation. These things are, I can't believe that that was so far in our past. But it says it's the 30th anniversary of the Vietnam Wall. Over 2 million visitors have visited the traveling Vietnam Wall, and this is a half-scale replica, and there are going to be people there that can point you to the proper panels. There's a museum, and it's, as I said, it's open 24 hours starting on October 25th at 10 a.m. So this is your opportunity to go and check it out. I think you'll be amazed. It's a very solemn and special. It's a special display,
mm-hmm.
And I think that you will find it amazing.
And you don't even have to be a Vietnam veteran to attend that.
No. The first time I went,
take the kids too. Yeah,
I think the first time I went and saw the traveling wall, I had not even been to Washington yet, and I walked in. It was at the old State Fairgrounds in Detroit, and I walked in, and some guy just walked up to me, and I had a business suit on, and he just walked up and he says, "Who are you looking for?" And it was very timely because I was looking for a specific panel. And they know, and they're very kind and they're very understanding, and it says that you can bring mementos, leave them at the wall if you want to, and those will go back to Washington into the museum there. So,
and docents will be there to answer questions in that.
That's October 25th starting at 10 a.m. at the Ford Motor Company World Headquarters. It's the Wall That Heals.
Yeah, Michigan Avenue and the Southfield Freeway. Okay, we're coming up to our first guest, Dr. Rebecca Grant, who will be discussing RPAs, remote piloted aircraft. We'll be right back after this important message.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back right here. How's our bump going? Anyway, that's okay, folks. We're coming live. You know, we've done all those programs live, and that's what makes it really exciting. My first guest today, Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant has been on this program in the past, and you want to get those programs, you want to go to our archive and scroll through and find the Dr. Grant. Dr. Grant is president of IRIS, Independent Research, a public policy research organization located in Washington, D.C. Dr. Grant is also a director of the Washington Security Forum. That's a nonprofit founded in 2012 to encourage research and discussion on how national security connects to advanced science and technology. Dr. Grant is an active member of the Air Force Association. She writes regularly for the Air Force Magazine and served from 2008 to 2011 as the founding director of the Mitchell Institute. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Back with you, Bob and Dale.
Good morning.
And thanks again, Nina, for being on the spot. There we go. Dr. Grant, I want to start with this whole thing on RPAs, that when I read about Israel shooting one down and they didn't know where the country came from, that, like, what country? Wasn't it just the U.S.? And in further, in talking with you and doing further research, that is not the case. And as we get into that, we start with what is currently, today, the USAAF's drone, or RPA, what is the range right now that we have in the altitude of one of these?
The biggest remotely piloted airplane or unmanned plane, the longest, biggest range is the Global Hawk. It's enormous. It can fly up to 65,000 feet. It's a high altitude aircraft. And it's flown nonstop from the U.S. to Australia.
And what powers these things?
This is pretty neat. This is a lovely plane. It was it's about 10 years old in design, and it's powered by a single jet engine, and it's curved, got a nice curved body and very long, thin wings. That enables it to fly very high. Now, it's quite unique, actually, in among all the UAVs in the world. It's very unique for its high altitude. The ones you might know better because they've been used a lot in Iraq and Afghanistan, Global Hawk has two, are the Predator and the Reaper. And those are smaller. They fly more in the medium altitude, so the 15 to 20,000 feet. But they have an endurance of over 20 hours. So they are pretty neat craft. You can see why they've become so popular with U.S. forces and why other versions of unmanned planes have become pretty popular around the world.
Has any other country had the technical stream that the U.S. has now, the total advantage that the U.S. has on these RPAs?
Yeah, I'd say the U.S. is ahead, but the fact with the unmanned planes is the technology itself is very old. The first ones appeared in World War I. So the models, like there was a Sperry drone that was experimented with in World War One, and then the very famous one came right at the end of World War One. It was called the Kettering Bug. So as soon as man learned to fly, they also learned to fly with unmanned planes. What's made a big difference in recent years is space and the availability of the global positioning system. That GPS signal makes it possible for unmanned planes to have much more precise navigation. And that's allowed them to develop into bigger and, frankly, more expensive, more valuable aircraft that can fly these longer missions, because they can go out and fly them and you can get them back with the GPS.
Now, when they're launched, are they launched from the belly of a plane, or do they actually take off from a runway?
All types. Some come off of a ship, but most are runway types. And they kind of fall into two categories. They're the ones that you launch and that are lighter weight, lower altitude, that fly below 15,000 feet, including this one that we saw shot down last weekend. And then there are the bigger ones, the Predator, Reaper, and the Global Hawks. Those are actually pilots and sensor operators who sit at command posts and fly those aircraft. So they're not on board the plane, but they're at a ground station flying the aircraft.
There are two development streams. Why don't you talk about those?
Yeah, I'd say at least two. But the real dividing line is the altitude and endurance. Probably the most popular type is the Predator, and then the ones that are a bit lighter than that. So let me talk for a minute about the one that was shot down about a week ago. This is from a family called the Ababil. It's an Iranian design. It's very simple. It looks like something you could build out in your garage. It's about 3 meters long, about 9 feet long, carries a little bit less than 100 pounds of payload, and it has a pretty decent range, anywhere from around 100 to 150 miles, depending on what they're doing. But it's very simple, pair of wings, little engine, and a little bit of guidance on board, and off you go. And that's what we're seeing proliferated around the world.
And what is the second stream on there, the high altitude or the low altitude?
The second stream is the ones that the U.S. has certainly a lot more of. Now, we have a number, obviously not of the Ababils, but of smaller remotely piloted vehicles, such as the Raven and some others. But the second stream really is this family that starts with Predator and Reaper and goes on up to Global Hawk. These are bigger aircraft, and what's significant about them is they can carry more. So that means they can carry more sensors, and that could be cameras or infrared detection, and they can also, not the Global Hawk, but the Predator and Reaper can also carry weapons. So when you hear about news headlines about drone strikes against terrorist targets, for example, that will generally be the Predator and the Reaper that are carrying those out, because they're able to carry up to 500 pounds of weapons, in some cases more.
Well, we're going to fast forward to a spot, because I want to be sure and get this in. Dale and I were talking at breakfast this morning, and I don't think anybody out there really realizes this, what the impact, RPAs are going to have on military tactics, when you said something about a swarm tactic. Now think of this, folks, swarm of these. I mean, you have to shoot them down in the air, swarm of these. We're talking hundreds at a time, coming on target. Wow. And what's the U.S. doing, the USAF is doing right now to counter that, Dr. Grant?
Right. Well, there's a lot going on, and it's not just the Air Force, but the Navy as well, and the Army is doing a lot of thinking about how to handle the drone threat, because if you remember back in the first Gulf War of 1991, there was the big swing of ground forces called the left hook, mm-hmm. and that was unobserved by the Iraqis at the time. If they'd had a drone operation, they might well have been able to see our ground forces moving. So the Army is thinking pretty hard about how to counter these as well. And a lot of it is pretty simple stuff. You want to be able to first detect them with radar, almost like a counter-battery type of radar, something that's optimized to look at the altitudes where they're flying, whether that's low or medium, and then have something to identify them for sure. so that you know what kind of aircraft that is, and then to shoot it down. And you can do that with another aircraft. You can do that with ground systems. You can do it with something like the Phalanx, or a good old 50-caliber gun, if that's what you have around. So, but the important note here is that defending against unmanned planes that our adversaries may have is becoming a task that we're learning how to do, and we expect to have to do that routinely in the future.
Now, this is all being tested right now on exercises, and one of them was Black Dart. What were the results of that exercise, Dr. Grant?
Right. Well, they've just run that again for 2012, but Black Dart is an exercise series that's run out at Point Magoo, out at the Naval Air Station there in California. And among the things they do is they put up some RPAs, and they see if they can find them and correctly identify them and then practice how to shoot them down. And so that kind of brings us back in a way to what Israel did against the Hezbollah drone last week. And it's pretty interesting if you take it apart. The first thing they did was they detected the drone coming in, we believe, over the water. They saw that on their radar. Then they had to scramble a couple of fighter jet interceptors to go up and get to the altitude where this drone was. The next really important step was the Israeli fighters flew alongside the drone. That let them identify it, essentially, and be really clear that it was the Hezbollah Ababil drone. And then they shot it down. They waited till it had come out over an area in the desert, the Negev desert there, and shot it down. Don't know how, but easy for an F-15 or F-16 that the Israelis have to do that as a gun kill and just take that drone down. So that's the sequence of what we're learning how to do, to detect them, identify them, yes, this is an enemy drone, and get that response in place to take them down.
Now, when you think of this, folks, a swarm like angry bees are coming at you. These are the kind of things that we thought we would see on something like Star Wars or any other the futuristic films. Dale, do you have something to add to this? I see you're shaking your head.
No, I'm just amazed at the number of countries that have the drones. And I guess maybe I don't know if primetime media is covering these things or not. And that's one of the things that attracted us to this story, Dr. Grant, was that you mentioned all of the countries that are involved in development of drones, and that some of them are just merely copying what we have and building their own, such as China.
That's right, and absolutely, Dale. And it's what's interesting is that, as I said before, the technology of the airplane itself isn't that hard. Now, it's a little bit different when you talk about something as sophisticated as the Global Hawk, but these Ababil drones are very easy to build, and ones like them. And what they do is they give you the ability to do some reconnaissance, which is what I think this one was doing. And it really changes things. And you might be interested to know the U.S. has shot down an Ababil drone as well. There was an F-16 that shot one down over Iraq back in February of 2009. It was very similar to what happened last weekend. They'd watched this drone come out of Iranian airspace this time, watched it for about an hour, and by the time it got 60 miles north of Baghdad, which is a pretty long way from Iran, they brought over one of the F-16s up on combat air patrol and shot it down. So it's something that we see happening more often. There was a case in 2008, the Russians shot down a Georgian, Republic of Georgia drone. So MiG-29 got a kill on a Republic of Georgia drone. I think we'll just see this now as something that happens in just about every conflict, since so many countries around the world are building drone fleets.
And folks, when you think of this, when you think of this, the swarm tactic, think of them all being armed. Now, right now, with current technology, we have to shoot them down. You can't. It's just not going to happen with current weapons technology, but many experts believe that laser weapons would be effective against swarming RPAs. Comment on that, Dr. Grant.
That's right. What's so scary about the swarm is the idea that it can come from all directions at once. So the airmen like to call that a multi-axis attack. the incidents we've talked about where one jet chases one drone are quite different. That's like a linear attack. This is a swarm coming at maybe a force on the ground or coming at an air base or coming at a ship at sea from all different directions. So you have to be able to track and fire. And what's neat about the potential for laser weapons in the future is the ability to get off a great many shots at once and in multiple directions. So you can slew a future type of laser weapon around and really quickly get most of that swarm so that you just have a few coming through, or hopefully none at all.
Now, when it really gets down to the basics, many planners think about the, really the basics of the RPA threat. It's a basic of air superiority. It's just another platform in which to conduct military operations. You want to comment on that, Dr. Grant?
That's right, and it can be a very effective one. And so in a way, it demonstrates the air superiority. Now, the good news is that most of the drones, or unmanned planes, as I like to call them, are pretty light and pretty easy to shoot down. Again, there's some exceptions, like the Global Hawk, which is at extremely high altitude, very robust aircraft. But the types that we're seeing and hearing stories of, whether it's the Hezbollah with Ababil or China with some of the RPAs that they've had operating out in the Pacific, that you can shoot them down. But on the other hand, that's the appeal. They are expendable when they're the lower altitude or medium altitude aircraft. So what they're used for is to attempt to use some of that air superiority. Now, they're never going to be better than a fighter that has the armaments and the speed and maneuverability, but they can certainly cause a lot of problems for a ship at sea, for forces on the ground, and they really present a challenge. So in order to have air superiority, you're going to have to clear the sky of the unmanned planes that may be watching what your forces are doing.
I know that you mentioned here in your article, by the way, this article, folks, is at Air Force Magazine. That's Air Force Magazine, August of 2012. Go ahead and Google that and read the article right from Dr. Grant. And one of the other weapons that is recommended or looked at for you is the F-35 fighter. Now, want to comment that? That's the Allied Strike Fighter, correct?
That's right. The Joint Strike Fighter that's in early production for the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, and for several of our allies. And what's great about the F-35 is it has very sophisticated detection systems. It has an infrared detection system that can see 360 degrees around the aircraft, the first of its kind. And what will help there is that as it looks for the slower flying unmanned planes, it can see them above, below, at any angle. So you could put an F-35 into an area of swarming unmanned planes, and it could track and detect them from all angles at once. So in a way, the F-35 is the ultimate antidote to enemy unmanned planes because of its ability to track them and obviously to shoot them down.
I have to ask this. Have they actually have predators going after predators? Is that available? Is that true?
Well, I tell you, here's the highlight story of the Predator and its young life. Right before the Second War with Iraq began in 2003, our Predators had been up looking over into Iraqi airspace, and the Iraqis let's go up and shoot them down. So they decided they would put an air-to-air missile on one of our Predators and see if they could take down an Iraqi MiG-29. And darn, they almost did it. They got the Predator in the right spot, got the missile locked in on the MiG-29, as it came out of the no-fly zone area, and the missile just didn't leave the rail quite in time. So in the end, it didn't work. The Predator itself was shot down, but it was up there challenging for air superiority against a frontline fighter. So that's what we'll see. And we may see unmanned vehicles shooting at other unmanned vehicles. Right now, the advantage is to use, as the Israelis did last weekend, to use a fighter against enemy UAVs, and for us to use our fighters, F-16s, and in future F-35 against unmanned planes.
Dr. Grant, it's a question about the new pilots. I know that the Air Force, I believe, has set up a training program for pilots of these drones that are not actual pilots. They're more technology-oriented or more video game-oriented. Is that right?
Dale, that's right. When they first brought the drones in, they wanted to make sure that that it succeeded, and they actually took pilots from F-15s, F-16s. They picked the best of the best to make sure that they could really fly the Predator and get the most out of it. But the demand has grown, and the force of Predators and Reapers has gotten much bigger, and the Air Force did set up a track where young officers could learn to fly the Predator from their ground station without having gone through pilot training themselves. And they had a pretty good success rate. I think the first class graduated about 80% of the ones they brought in, and they've decided to make that a career track so that now in the Air Force, flying unmanned planes from the ground station is a career path all of its own.
I think that's amazing. That's for all those pilots wannabes who can't pass the, you know, the sight test or whatever test it was, have an opportunity.
That's right. And so the Predator pilot force right now is an interesting mix. It's mostly predominantly still pilots who went through undergraduate pilot training and flew tankers or bombers or fighters or C-17 airlifters or whatever else, and are doing an assignment in the Predator Reaper force. But we do have some new officers that are flying the Predator, having just learned to fly unmanned vehicles only. It's really neat to see them out and doing that, and they're really pumped. They love this assignment. They think it's really fun to do this and a great way to do the Air Force mission and serve the country.
Well, Dr. Grant, you came on with such a short notice. I first contacted Dr. Grant on Wednesday, and I did, you know, every time that I have you on a program, and once again, by the way, folks, go to our archive section to have other Dr. Grant programs, I see you on the military channel, and you were on twice. They did the bomber one, and I can't remember what the second one was, but they did one on the bomber. So having you on the air, Dr. Grant, is so gracious for you to get yourself up. Where are you calling from, Washington?
Yes, from the Washington, D.C. area.
And what's the weather like?
It is a perfect fall day here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Could not be more beautiful.
Well, once again, we want to thank you. Dale, do you have anything else to say?
No, I just want to thank you, Dr. Grant, for what you're doing, and I really recommend to our civilian audience especially to go to the Air Force Magazine website and read this article yourself. It's unbelievable and really expands your mind, as they say, to the possibilities out there.
Absolutely. Dr. Grant, you have yourself a great day, and actually, we'd like to have you on again in the future to talk about this a little bit more in depth. So we want to thank you again for being on the air.
Sounds good to me. Thank you, Bob and Dale.
Got it. Wow. You know, you just can't get enough of this information.
No, you can't. It's amazing when you think about the possibilities of what the Air Force and all the other different branches are doing with these drones. And I was thinking about when you're talking about swarming, some of the very early drones, and I'm moving my hands, which isn't helping anybody, but were really no bigger than your two fists held together. They're like little gnats up there, and they had a little camera, and so they would follow the troops around, and how they've grown from that. For those of you who have ever seen those little helicopters that you can remotely control around,
right.
That's sort of the same thing.
That's the same thing.
To these huge drones now that, you know, fly at 60,000 feet, you know, what you say, from California to Australia. So I would say probably in 20 years that there's going to be a lot of remote-controlled bombers, fighter planes, and everything else, I'll bet you.
We have finally crossed the technology. This is like going from the B-26, B-25 to the B-29. This is so advanced, and yet it's not advanced. It's actually here right now and has been around for a while. Wow. Well, you hear it right here on Veterans Radio, folks. Absolutely. We get those hard-hitting guest and take on those features. We're not afraid of anything. All right, Nina, are you ready? Let's go to our next break. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO, part of the Ave Maria Network. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Fund Bank, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Detroit, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, and WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. With me today is Mr. Dale Throneberry, and our next guest will be Mr. Bing West, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense and a former Marine. He's a co-author.
Never a former Marine.
I know. I don't know what to say. Okay, he's a Marine, folks. They're always there. Absolutely, Semper Fi. He's a co-author of his latest book with a Medal of Honor recipient, Sergeant Dakota Meyer. The name of the book, Into the Fire. That's a first-hand account of the most extraordinary battle in the Afghan War. That was by Randon House, and we'll give you all that information in just a moment. And before I turn this over to Dale, as Dale has had more experience with Mr. West. By the way, once again, folks, you can go to our archives and get these past programs with Bing West. I really recommend you do that. It's very, very insightful. Absolutely. Bing, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay. What caught my attention when I looked at the article of the Wall Street Journal, October 1st, 2012, the green on blue attack. And tell us about that.
Well, this is different than any other war insurgency that I've been able to research. When you get a breakdown in discipline to the point where your ally, the people you're trying to train, are shooting you. And the general in charge out there came out and said it has to do with the culture, not that the Taliban are inducing all these attacks. Well, holy smokes, then it's even a worse issue. If it's the culture that's causing it, what the heck are we doing having our troops out there? And when I was out there with them going on patrol, when you're on patrol, after a while you don't think that the man behind you may plug you. And now I understand that they're basically putting more and more restrictions and saying we're not going to be out with the Afghans. Well, the questions I asked in my op-ed is to any general, well, general, then what's the mission that you tell the squad? Are they to patrol in place of the Afghans because we can't trust the Afghans and therefore we're going to do the job for them? I mean, it just doesn't make sense anymore to me. It really doesn't. And I'm not a pacifist by any means. As you indicated, I'm a Marine. I'm a grunt. But when you can't tell a squad leader what the mission is, you better think twice about what you're doing sending them out there.
Well, Bing, this is Dale. I want to welcome you also again.
Thanks,
back,
Dale.
Back to Veterans Radio. And as doing our little self-promotion, we had Bing West on earlier this year with his book, The Snake Eaters. And that was about the ending of the war in Iraq and about what was happening over there. And I found your editorial...
Actually, if I could, Dale, that was my son, Owen, who did The Snake Eaters.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Owen, no, that's right. Owen, too, is a Marine. And he works in New York City, but he takes about 4 to 6 months leave of absence every couple of years and goes back, joins the Marines Force Recon, and goes out and trains Iraqis, Afghans, et cetera, and then goes back to his day job.
I don't know how you do that. I mean, that. Well, we talked about that earlier this morning when before we came on the air, and we were talking about how you guys go back and forth all the time, especially now with the mission clearly undefined, it sounds like, and, you know, putting your life in danger, walking, you know, trying to train these Afghan soldiers and to take over their own country, you know, protect their own country so that we can leave in a timely fashion. And as soon as we start doing that, they seem to, many of them seem to be turning their guns on us for some reason. As you mentioned, it's cultural rather than anything else. So what you're saying is, let's get out now. Why put another American life in danger?
You put me on the horns of a dilemma. and let me come back at it this way.
Okay.
In the book I wrote with the Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Dakota Meyer, Dakota was absolutely insistent that the Afghans he was with laid down their lives for him in a tremendous battle, and they never flinched, and some of the Americans did. So Dakota's experience was very positive with the Afghans. I mean, it was a tragic battle, but he was let down by his own chain of command and not by the Afghans. On the other hand, I've been out in other cases where Afghans have, out on patrol in the middle of nowhere, where one Afghan accosted me with his rifle, another one tried to push me around, and I had to lay hands on him, which is the first time I'd done that in a long time with a soldier. Mm-hmm. And I came away with the feeling what you're dealing with Afghans is a bunch of rough, undisciplined eighth graders. And they will not turn against the bully among them, and they may not support them. Therefore, you don't have an organized military the way we're used to. And they cannot predict, because they're immature, many of them, what the other guy is going to do. The most interesting thing about these attacks by the Afghans is that the Afghans don't know they're coming either. And some of them are definitely put up by the Taliban, but others appear to be just people who shoot first and think second. And when you get into that kind of a situation, staying two more years to patrol for them, that doesn't make sense to me militarily, strategically, or ethically. So, reluctantly, I have come to the conclusion, time for us to quietly pull our forces back. And then let's see what the Afghans do. Mm-hmm. Practically every single Marine, without exception, every single Marine that I was, from a colonel on down that I was out with 2 weeks ago, basically said to me the same thing. Bing, when we pull back, they're going to pull back. And so what I told the top of the chain of command is, pull back now, and let's see how they set up their lines while we can still help them. Don't wait until the end of 2014 and have the thing collapse. And the answer was, but we have to safeguard the election for the Afghan president in 2014. And at that point, I just throw up my hands and say, good luck to you.
Well, yeah. Good luck is right. You mentioned in your editorial that after some of these incidents that, you know, that there's a stand down where the Americans will not go out on patrol with the Afghan troops for a period of time. And then it seems like they kind of inch their way back into them and trying to. I don't know how they sell the message even, you know, to the troops that are there.
They don't, and that's what frustrated me. Our troops are willing to take huge risks when they believe there's a reason for doing so. This group that I was with in Sangin province down in Helmand, at the bottom of the country, that has taken more casualties and had harder fighting than any other place in the country. When I was out with them last year, you ready for this? When we went on patrol, they strapped tourniquet straps to the outside of their thighs before we left the wire, because they expected that one or more of them would be hit, lose his legs, and they didn't want to waste the time and bleed to death. Therefore, they wore the tourniquets so they could just cinch them up tight. Can you imagine doing that day after day after day? And finally, I realized how they were measuring success. When I lived with them, they measured success by waiting for the gunfight and then being able to kill some of those son of a guns on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, wow, the generals are giving us all this talk about this is non-kinetic and we're out here to win hearts and minds and make projects. And here I am out with these grim young men just looking to even the score. And I thought, this is the gulf between our generals and our troops. Our generals better be darn careful because the entire force is getting very cynical about what they're hearing from the top.
I think when I read that in your article about the going out with tourniquets already on and ready to use, I just said, can you imagine the emotional stress that these men are under, the heightened sense of attention to everything around them? You know, you wonder then, how do they come home and just drive down the street without, you know, flinching at every little sound that they hear?
Well, you know, that's... Now we're going into a different subject, a psychological subject. I have to choose my words carefully, but people are different. I mean, I've been on battlefields, hundreds of patrols, et cetera, and I come home, sleep like a baby. You know, there are many of them. The Battalion 3-1 that had the toughest fighting in Fallujah was very, very proud that when the battalion came back, they didn't have one case of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know a lot of veterans listen to me and say, come on, Bing, that's a lot of baloney. They had to have some. But they took pride that very few of them were seriously mentally defected by it. I'm just reading this book that has a scary implication. This book indicates that during the battle for Iwo Jima, when we had 5,000 Marines killed and 18,000 wounded, my gosh,
mm-hmm.
That there were 2,000 cases of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
They called it shell shock in those days.
Right.
So 10% of the force in the toughest fight on Iwo Jima that we had during World War II broke down one way or the other eventually. 10%. Today, they say that if it's a National Guard unit that goes over to Afghanistan and reservists, they have up to 20% to 25%, but most of them never even are in one firefight. I mean, among the regular troops now, they're saying it's 8 to 10% of everybody, but very few of them ever fire their rifles. So what's going on here? And this reporter said you can track it with expenditures that now you receive $2,600 a month for the rest of your life
mm-hmm.
if you're diagnosed with PTSD and you still have nightmares, tax-free. So if you start putting out a whole series of monetary incentives, then you have to have a way of determining, is it the monetary incentive that's causing a lot of this, or is it a change in society? And I think it probably has... I mean, look, you know, I admire policemen and firefighters, too, but look at the number that suddenly are disabled just in the last year before they leave the force.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be careful that we don't have ethical corruption in our organizations because we're offering free money. I'm not trying to say that a lot of people don't need help, but the escalating numbers are troubling.
Well, that's a whole different subject.
It is a whole different. And I'm not an expert on it. And it, you know, it's like the third rail. You want to stay away from it.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you. We're coming up on a break, right, Bob?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
So you're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO. Hit it, Nina.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and with us on the air right now is Mr. Bing West, co-author of Medal of Honor recipient, Sergeant Dakota Moyer of Into the Fire. Dale, go ahead, take it from there.
Well, Bing, we want to help tell this story also. So tell us about Dakota Moyer and Into the Fire a little bit.
Well, I'm glad we can switch to this one, because this is an uplifting story.
Yes.
Dakota is a 21-year-old corporal, and he's a tough kid off a farm from Kentucky. He's the sniper in his team of four advisors at a lonely outpost. And they're brought down to join some other advisors and 100 Afghans to go in to have a talk with the villagers in a remote village called Ganjigal on the Pakistani border. And it turns out they're set up, and there's a huge ambush. Now, Dakota has been left behind with the trucks, and he listens to the firing, and he asks permission to come in with his Humvee with a 50 caliber on the top. And he's told no. The first sergeant tells him, no, stay out of here. We're too busy. Stay out. And he's ordered time and time again to stay out. And he finally disobeys orders, says, I'm not staying out, and roars in. He ends up the only target on the battlefield that is moving. And he's in a hail of fire. He's picking up wounded, mostly Afghan soldiers. He's trying to get to his team. He fought for 5 hours and five times went up this valley where he was the lone target. The only reason he's alive today is just, I think, because, you know, sometimes you can walk through a rainstorm and you don't get wet or something, you know, some weird thing. And that's what happened with Dakota. And then at the end of the battle, he is furious because they couldn't get any artillery support, because the rules of engagement that the generals had given is that you can't fire into a village. But all the villagers were shooting at them, and his team was killed. And it affected him tremendously, and he went over and saw the president for a beer the night before he was going to get the Medal of Honor, but I knew what he was doing. And he told the president, Mr. President, I don't want that medal tomorrow. Please call this ceremony off, because you're giving me an award, and Marines get awarded for what they did, not what they didn't do, and I didn't bring back my team. So it's... It's going to affect Dakota for a long time. And the other thing that happened after the battle was that there was a botched investigation. So the Marines insisted on a second investigation. And then there was another young man on the battlefield, a captain in the Army by the name of William Swenson, with Dakota, who was right beside Dakota. So he, too, was put in for the Medal of Honor. And the Army lost the recommendation, and as of today, 4 years later, he still has received nothing. So there are a lot of implications to this story, both about the bravery of Dakota and about the ineptitude and maybe some cover-ups by our higher command.
I'm speechless when I listen to that. When you think about that, the people above you are the ones that you're supposed to trust, because they're the ones that are sending you out on these missions, and they supposedly have, you know, a clear vision of what they're going to be doing. But it sounds like that many things in the military haven't changed that much in the last 50 years.
We all have that. The biggest problem that we have now in Afghanistan is that, and we did it in Iraq, is that our generals came up with a strategy called nation building. And they said that our soldiers would be nation builders. No, they're not. Our soldiers don't know how to build nations. But the general said the way we're going to win these wars is not by killing the enemy, but by persuading the people that the enemy has nothing to offer. Therefore, the people will turn away from the enemy. Well, you may not like the mafia among you, but if the mafia can pop you and no policeman's going to help you, you're not going to turn against the mafia. So the entire concept from the top was wrong. And then when Karzai, who was the president of Afghanistan and a very volatile and I don't think trustworthy person as a leader, when he would complain because, of course, unfortunately, some civilians are going to die in war, that our generals reacted by making our rules of engagement more and more strict to restrict our soldiers and force them to take higher risks for the Afghan people, and that's when cynicism begins to set in.
Mm-hmm.
Our troops now are very, very cynical. Why go out on patrol if you get ambushed and you can't use your weapons?
Is this a kind of like a Vietnam syndrome that's carried over over the last 50 years. I was just reading a book by Marvin Kalb, and he's talking about how the shadow of Vietnam is still hanging over all of these decisions that the politicians and the military are making. Could you comment on that? Because I know you did a book on counterinsurgency.
Correct. I wrote the book.
Yeah, you wrote the book.
My Marine. The Marine unit I was with, we were 485 days in a Vietnamese village, and I got to know advising pretty well.
Yeah,
but,
I would say.
What happened in this particular case, I don't think was any hangover, because most of the people now had no comprehension of Vietnam. What happened here was the people at the top, the very top, our top generals, believe that they had a strategy that has totally failed, and that strategy was nation building, and they never shifted strategies. In Afghanistan, we only need 10,000 or 20,000 troops. That's all. If our objective in Afghanistan is only to prevent terrorists from attacking us here in the United States of America, we can do that with a handful, because as your prior guest was indicating, our drones are so fantastic. Our spy network is unbelievable,
mm-hmm.
And we can move our special operations forces by helicopter at night, and no one can stand up against them. And we don't need all the rest of this stuff that we're doing with our troops, and it's not helping. It's not helping the Afghans, because they become dependent upon us, and they get this entitlement attitude that we owe them. And it's certainly not helping our soldiers and Marines, because they're taking risks, and they don't understand why they're taking the risks. And what do we do at the top? We change generals and reward them and send them off to other jobs. And so nobody is ever responsible. This thing is nuts.
I understand it, Bing. It's so frustrating when you look at this. There was another author we had on, I think his name was Nathaniel Fick, I think it was.
Oh, sure, Nate Fick. Good guy.
Yeah, and his story was that, you know, that the American foreign policy is at the end of a gun held by a 19-year-old. And they're trying to get these 19-year-olds, what they have just spent, 6 months training them how to kill people, to now work with them and nation build.
Correct, but...
And how do
but
you
that's
do that?
Number one, not the mission of a 19-year-old that joined the Marine Corps or the Army. And
right.
And there's no historical evidence that America or any other country can build another country and nation build it. And third, our military is a perfect socialist organization. I mean, consider it's absolutely socialist.
Yes.
You don't do anything to earn your money by day labor or something. You know, you basically are in there and you're paid a certain rate. Everyone's paid the same rate. They're all eligible for promotion at the same time. If you do a good job and you stay for 20 years, you have a good pension for the rest of your life. You obey your orders. You're part of a system. Big Army, a big Marine Corps. That is the perfect socialist system. Now, we come from a capitalist country. If you're a general, you know nothing about capitalism. You're not an entrepreneur. You haven't started your own platoon. You haven't run a profit and loss center. You have no competence in capitalism or free enterprise. That's the one thing you don't have. So what makes you capable of becoming a nation builder based upon the principle of democracy and capitalism? That's not your skill.
I think that's a great analogy, and I like that a lot, because as you were saying, I was thinking about all of the, the tribal leaders or the mullahs, in Afghanistan that are controlling their own little forces, and some of them are just, tough guys that are, have the bigger guns or whatever it happens to be, but some of them develop their network like a business owner.
Well, and we, I mean, consider it. Supposing I said to you, let's go out and drive to Nevada and go out to an Apache or a Navajo reservation and meet with the chief. And he drives up in his Chevrolet or something and says, hi, guys. And we say, hi. They say, listen, chief, We're Democrats, and President Obama believes in an awful lot of what you believe in, and you, we know you'd really like to help him out. So why doesn't your tribe join the United States right now? We know you don't have to because, you know, we agreed on that a long time ago. And then you can vote. And the chief looks at me for a minute and says, "Well, wait a minute, white man. You know, this is my reservation. You know, you kicked me around for a long time, but we reached an agreement 100 years ago. We like things the way they are. Thank you very much for your invitation. Now, you please leave my reservation."
Mm-hmm.
We go over to Afghanistan, where they are hurtling headlong all these tribes into the 9th century, mm-hmm. and we say to them, "You don't have a choice. You know, starting next week, you're all Democrats and you're going to vote." And then we're surprised what happens. I mean, mm-hmm. God bless us. You know what happened to us at the beginning of this in 2000, 2001? We were hit by terrorists, and we should have gone back after the terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, as a country, we were so cocksure at that time. We didn't realize that we were heading toward economic bedlam. And as an entire country, we had hubris. We had overwhelming pride that we could do just about anything. And it wasn't just President Bush. It wasn't just the Congress. Mm-hmm. It was all of us. We had this attitude. And now we've woken up to reality.
Right. Yes. And it's time for us to go, I think.
I agree with you, but you know, again, you don't trumpet it. You don't do what Vice President Biden did the other night and get up there and say, "I guarantee you, well, even in 2014, oh, my God, that is a dumb statement. You don't do mm-hmm. things like that. You just quietly pull back. But I do not believe that you ever say all Americans have left Afghanistan. You keep sending signals that if you're the terrorists and you're trying to organize, we know you're there and we're going to get you.
And if we do leave, we can come back just as easily.
Well, as long as you have the drones mm-hmm. overhead, everyone knows you're still there.
I
see,
totally
it, it didn't really come up in the conversation yesterday with your prior guest. But the interesting thing about the drones is that they make noise; they're not soundless,
right?
And so everyone hears them. So you see where I'm going?
Yep.
There's a huge deterrent effect to keep your drones moving around.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, there is, because if you're on the ground, the troops will tell you, you know, the insurgents, they hear that noise, they go to ground, they know you're still looking at them. So just keep those drones moving around, moving around, moving around, and everyone knows the Americans are still here.
Bing, this is Bob Gould. We're getting to the end of the program. We've only got about a minute left. I'd like to give you that opportunity to tell our listeners how, we got Christmas coming up, how they can get your book, and what's all the contact information?
Well, thanks very much. Our book is now on the bestseller list. It's called Into the Fire. It was written by Dakota Meyer, and I simply took his notes and tapes. It's on all bookstores. If it isn't, tell the bookstore, what are you doing? Because unlike, there are 500 books about the U.S. Navy SEALs, and that's more than there are SEALs in mm-hmm. country. So we're fascinated with commandos. But Dakota represents all the normal guys who go in only for 4 years. We do not have a professional Army and Marine Corps. We have volunteers. 85% of everyone who serves gets out in 4 years, just like Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And if everyone stayed in, like the SEALs of the Special Forces, in 10 years, 20 years, you'd have 50-year-olds. And you can't run an army that way. And so Dakota's story represents all of us. And it's called Into the Fire, and he's a great guy.
Thank you very much, Bing. And we'll be looking forward to having you on the program again. You have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Thanks, Dale.
Thank you, Bing.
Well, we've got 10 seconds left. Right, Nina? I don't hear the theme coming up. There we go. There it is. Okay, today, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.